My name is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. My background is in political science and in theology. I have a graduate of Union Theological Seminary. I have a Master of Divinity degree. Have spent a good part of the past 15 years dealing with issues related to hunger. In my introduction into issues of U.S. farming and the farm crisis really came kind of through the back door of just recognizing how important a healthy, viable U.S. farm economy is, particularly in the future, I would guess, but in terms of present world food needs as well. I'm going to tonight try to talk about some parallels between some of the problems I see in U.S. agriculture and facing U.S. farmers and some of the problems facing the people of Central America, and to try to build some relationships between those issues. My wife, Sarah, and I, as most of you know, lived and worked in Central America for 2 years. I came back about a year ago and have been traveling to that region over the past 5 years. By way of introduction, I wanted to start with a few biblical observations about economics and land. If you read the Bible, or as I read the Bible, I'll put it that way, as I read the Bible, I don't find any prescription for exactly what an economy should look like. You're not going to find that. It was written too long ago. But we can find, I think, some helpful hints as to what would make up a viable economy. And I want to mention three, and I'm going to focus a little bit more on one. The first observation is that the way we should judge whether an economy is working or not is based on the well-being of the poor, or the situation of the poor, not the situation of the rich. From a biblical perspective, we're not to look at gross national product, we're not to look at how well the rich classes are doing. We're to look at what's happening with the poor. And that involves, for many of us, kind of flipping our understanding of what's going on with economics on its head. And I would argue that unless we do that, we'll never understand the problem of world hunger. Okay, so that's one observation. A second biblical observation on economics is that the biblical writers focus on sufficiency and not affluence. That the goal of economics seems to be sufficiency for all. And in fact, there are all kinds of dangers related to affluence and wealth that the biblical writers point out. And to point to some ideas of sufficiency, you remember the story of manna in the wilderness. And what happens when people gather more than they need, it spoils. Or the feeding of the 5,000 story. Or in our Lord's Prayer, we pray, give us this day our daily bread, that which we need sufficient for the day. The examples of the early church and their sharing. There's a whole lot of passages that we could cite. A third observation about the Bible and economics, and this ties in more directly with our issue of land, is that the biblical writers seem to say that equality or equity is the foundation for spiritual health as well as for economic health. That without a high degree of equality, you're going to have economic problems like hunger, like degradation. But the biblical writers also say without a high degree of equality, you have a spiritually unhealthy situation. And so what did they do? When they talked about the economics of their time, they laid out a number of key things. One provision was the Jubilee. And the Jubilee meant that every 50 years, land was to be redistributed. Why? Because the biblical writers seemed to understand that regardless of exactly what kind of economy you were living under, you were going to build up gradually more and more inequalities, and that there needed to be some kind of leveling process. The theological justification given for this, and this is in Exodus, is that it's God who owns the land, and that we are stewards of that land, and that all of God's people have rights in relation to the fruits of the land. Another provision in the Bible which related specifically to the land were the sabbatical provisions and to economics. Gets at this point again of equity. The sabbatical provisions in the Old Testament said that every 7 years, slaves should be freed. And every 7 years, debts should be canceled. And the idea again was that there had to be a way of breaking out of the cycle of poverty, because what happens is people get locked into situations of poverty. And very importantly, every 7 years, the land was to lie fallow so that the land itself could be restored. There was a biblical concern for the care of soil, which was the productive resource on which all of us depend. The prophets continued this focus on equality, equity, and the centrality of land for spiritual health as well as for economic health. In Isaiah, there were repeated warnings of woe to those who had house and house and field to field until they're left alone in the land. Amos, in the first book that I wrote called Hunger for Justice, I think there's one copy left in the bookstore, I focused a lot on the prophet Amos and what was going on in the time of Amos. And during the time of Amos, it was a time of prosperity in Israel. It was a time of military security for Israel. And the wealthy classes thought things were great. And Amos comes along and starts issuing these condemnations. And they point to all the other nations around them and say, but Amos, look, God is rewarding us, obviously. You can't criticize us. We're wealthy. We must be doing things right. And Amos said, no, you're looking in the wrong place. You're looking at your own interest and you're ignoring the interests of the vast majority of the people who are being basically pushed off of the land. And what was happening during the time of Amos is that the grain merchants got monopoly power in the marketplace. They were using that power ruthlessly to wrest land away from small landholders. The rich were buying up the land of the poor, taking over it, basically through indebtedness, building their second homes on it. Archaeological excavations in this time reveal very distinct sections of the city where Amos prophesied. And again, the land was very central. Amos was condemning that concentration of land ownership. In the time of Jesus, the theme continues. What was happening in the time of Jesus is that land became a sort of tax shelter for the rich. That the Roman taxes were so severe, they were looking for outlets, and so they tried to get more and more land. Then what began to happen was that harsh taxes were imposed on the land. Well, that might be a way of getting some taxes from the rich, but it was also a way of foreclosing on the poor. And so you had more and more and more small landholders getting into debt and having their land taken away from them and even selling themselves into slavery, which was the next step that they made. Most of Jesus' followers came from this sector, from the sector of the marginal, from the sector of the oppressed, from the sector of the landless, people who knew indebtedness, who knew what it was like to be sold out. Read the New Testament and just see how many images Jesus uses that relate to that of indebtedness. It's very interesting that Jesus, if you read his first sermon in Luke, comes after the temptation narrative when Jesus is tempted with what kind of Messiah is he going to be? Is he going to be a miracle worker who jumps from the pinnacle of the temple? Is he going to be a miracle worker that turns stones into bread and therefore feeds the people, but the people themselves don't have to undergo any kind of changes? Is he going to be, and the devil tempts him with, the leader that's going to control all the nations of the world? No, Jesus refuses all those, comes down, gives his first sermon, and does it, quoting from Isaiah, and says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach good news to the poor, freedom to the captives, recovering of sight to the blind. And he announces the acceptable year of the Lord. What was he announcing? Probably a jubilee. Jesus offended a lot of the large landowners in his time. And it's one of the reasons that he was crucified. When we learn the Lord's Prayer, one version of it is, the oldest version, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. It's very likely that that was taken quite literally in terms of a prayer that we now translate. when you have the passage in the New Testament, the poor shall inherit the earth. Walter Brueggemann, the Old Testament scholar, says we should really translate that quite literally, the poor shall inherit the land. So land is a critical theme throughout the ministry of Jesus, and so is that issue of indebtedness. And it's not surprising that I believe it was in 66 AD when a war was breaking out after the death of Jesus, that war was breaking out, that eventually the temple was destroyed, that some of the Jewish leaders, the first thing they destroyed in the war against Rome was a section of the temple. Now, how could you possibly explain why Jews would destroy a section of the temple? What they destroyed was where the records of indebtedness were kept. Okay, that's some biblical background, just to give us a framework in which to think about some of these land issues. And now I'm going to move to Central America and then to our own farm crisis. Again, as I've been trying to do this week, I'm going to try to leave about half the time just for conversation and questions and discussion. In Central America today, and I would say in most underdeveloped countries around the world, where there is a great deal of social turmoil, as you know, one of the major reasons for that social turmoil is the issue of the land. Who owns it? Who controls it? How it's used? Who reaps the benefits from it? In Nicaragua, as you know, Nicaragua had a revolution in 1979, ousted a U.S.-backed dictatorship. At that time, one of the things that gave rise to this revolution against this dictator was that land was owned by a fraction of the people. Today in Guatemala, where in the rural areas half the children die before the age of 5, today in Guatemala, about 2% of the people, between 2 and 3% of the people, own 80% of the land in Guatemala. Now keep in mind, these are fundamentally rural societies, where access to land is absolutely central to the survival of people and to their ability to meet those sufficiency needs that I talked about earlier. In El Salvador, the U.S.-backed government of El Salvador, about 1.9% of the people owns over 60% of the land. It's the best land. It's the flat land. It's the land that's used primarily for the exportation of crops like coffee, sugarcane, cattle, etc. There's absolutely no coincidence that you have tremendous social turmoil in these places where there's a whole lot of economic injustice. It goes beyond the land. It touches all sectors of the economy, but land is really central. You are probably aware that the United States has, on occasion, actually facilitated a land reform. One of those cases was Taiwan. Another case was South Korea. But unfortunately, that's very rare. In El Salvador, for example, there's been a very cosmetic land reform under the United States tutelage that has not changed the structure at all, and the social turmoil continues to erupt. In Guatemala, 1954, a major change in government, an elected, democratically elected government, tried to implement a land reform that affected the United Fruit Company. And the United Fruit Company, along with U.S. government officials closely tied to it, arranged a coup and ousted the government and set off a wave of 30 years of unbelievable terror and repression. The World Bank has a statistic. If you want to remember one statistic that helps explain, for me at least, why there's a lot of social turmoil in a lot of the countries that we know as places that have extensive hunger, it's this statistic. They say that in 83 countries, 3% of the people own 80% of the land. Tremendous concentration of a very key wealth-producing resource, essential to the well-being of many people. Okay, if you look at agriculture in Central America, one of the things that you see is that each year, over the past, particularly I would say 20 years, under the so-called development strategies, that more and more of the land in Central America is shifting from food crops that were eaten by local people to the production of crops for export that end up on our tables. tremendous increase in the amount of food crops, as well as the traditional crops of coffee and bananas and tea and sugar cane and those kind of items. Tea not in Central America, but tea in other parts of the world. Increases in that acreage alongside increasing social inequality and increasing hunger. Now, let me be very clear about this. It's not that all exports are wrong. It's not that export agriculture is necessarily evil. But there are lots of questions. And one of the questions, obviously, is who benefits? Well, if you have 2 or 3% of the people owning the land, they obviously benefit, but the vast majority of landless people do not. Other beneficiaries are U.S. companies or others that provide pesticides and fertilizers to large landholders, U.S. companies and others from Western Europe who market those commodities, etc. But the poor in general are excluded, left out, or exploited. Now, it's also when the land is owned by the few and when an economy is controlled by the few, which is the case, and again, in most of the Central American countries, what you see is that export agriculture, the exportation of more and more food crops, more and more crops like coffee, ends up being the sector that pays for the luxury consumption of the rich. In other words, if you go to El Salvador, you'll see tremendous wealth. You'll see people living like the Rockefellers alongside people who have nothing. Export agriculture pays for their Mercedes Benzes. It pays for all those luxury items that they import. Okay, another problem with export agriculture in terms of who benefits is if you look at what's happened with prices in general over the past 25 years of commodities like sugar, coffee, bananas, those kinds of commodities, which are the principal exports of most of the Central American countries, is they've gone like this. I gave an example yesterday that Nicaragua could export 100 bags of coffee in 1970 and get 100 barrels of oil. 1982, just 12 years later, they got 3 barrels of oil. They lost 97% of the value of their principal export relative to oil. So what happens? Prices keep going down and down and down. The result is, rather than change that international economic system, as the underdeveloped countries have been demanding, they call for what they call a new international economic order. Fairer, higher, more stable prices for the things they export against more stable prices for the things they import. Rather than do that, what we've done instead over the past 25 years is we've given them access to a lot of credit. What does that mean? It means incredible indebtedness. Here's a truly alarming figure. This is not just Central America. This is the underdeveloped countries as a whole owed a debt of $43 billion in 1967. $43 billion. 1967. Today, guess how much? Any guesses? $100 billion. Let's try $1 trillion. $1 trillion. Absolutely incredible. And what that means is that a country like Nicaragua or El Salvador or Honduras or Brazil or Mexico, when you have that debt load, it puts tremendous pressure for you to increase even more your agricultural exports at the expense of your own food needs, because you've got to pay for the interest on that debt. And the International Monetary Fund goes in, and the international banking institution goes into a place like Mexico and says, if you want more loans, which you obviously desperately need, then you've got to cut all your social service programs to the poor, you got to cut any food subsidies to the poor, and you've got to give more incentives for export. Well, what I call that is death through international finance. That there are more people each year who die as a result of International Monetary Fund policies, in the sense that I'm talking about here, than died in all the ovens of Nazi Germany. And yet it's a very clean form of death that we're separated from. Okay, let me give you an example of what this means for Mexico. Mexico, you know that Mexico is a country with a lot of hungry people, right? I mean, that certainly is an image that most of us would carry. Do you know that Mexico is the world's 9th largest food producer? And yet it ranks 60th in consumption. And Mexico provides the United States with between a half and two-thirds of most of the winter and spring fresh winter and spring vegetables that we consume in this country. Tremendous pressure to export at the expense of your own people. Okay, let me now just touch on some parallels with the farm crisis, and then we'll open it up. Remember coming across, when I started to get interested in the farm crisis, I came across an article in Forbes magazine, 1966. It wasn't an article, it was a whole issue. The title of the issue in Forbes magazine was "Feeding the World's Hungry Millions, How It Will Mean Billions for U.S. Corporations." Interesting title. But what they predicted in this issue was that while at the same time the U.S. corporations would make billions of dollars feeding hungry people, selling them the fertilizer so they could grow more food, all those things, that we would witness a dramatic decline in the number of U.S. farmers. So in other words, world hunger was going to be good for business, it was going to be terrible for farmers. Well, in fact, what we've seen in the United States is that right now, the present rate of farm loss in the United States is running about 2,000 a week. 2,000 farmers are going out of business every week in the United States. We're seeing increased concentration of land ownership. Prudential Insurance Company is becoming one of the largest farm owners in the country. So, here's some parallels. So we're in the danger. It seems to me that the direction that we would like to go, if you look at Central America and you see that social turmoil, is we would like to have a broad base of land ownership in this country. We seem to be heading in the other direction, towards more concentrated land ownership. And I think we're paying a lot of associate costs. As I drive through rural Minnesota, there's a lot of boarded up buildings. There's a lot of small town businesses that go under when small farms go under, or medium sized farms go under. Okay, another parallel. I mentioned that the underdeveloped countries have been demanding a new international economic order. They're demanding fair trade, fair prices. U.S. farmers, for a long time, have been clamoring for a fair, more stable price. Now, there's a lot of divisions among farmers about how to reach that, and that's one of the problems. But without a fair price, what ends up happening? Tremendous debt load. So U.S. farm debt, this is one of the parallels, has moved from $20 billion in 1970 from $20 billion to $220 billion today. So a rather hefty increase in the farm debt. Now one other parallel. Remember the OPEC? When OPEC in the early 1970s started to really throw their muscle around and oil prices went way up, and they were talking about, they invented a new word. It was called petrodollars. We know what happened to those petrodollars? The oil-rich countries that were getting all these dollars coming in to pay for the oil, they sent them primarily back to U.S. and Western banks. Well, what does a bank do on it? A bank can't sit on it, right? They've got to get that money out there, and they've got to earn interest on it, or they're in trouble. The two groups that they targeted for their loans were the underdeveloped countries and U.S. farmers. Those were the two targets. The problem with that is that with the absence of a fair price, you end up simply giving more and more loans, but that debt continues to add and add and add, and eventually you have to pay the piper, which means you're one of those 2,000. Okay, another parallel is what? Let me see here just a second. Another parallel is that the United States is becoming increasingly desperate to export agricultural commodities as a way of trying to rescue other areas of our economy. Let me give you a couple of examples. Again, if you're interested in this in any kind of detail, in the first book I did called Hunger for Justice, I did a fairly extensive chapter on the use of food as a weapon. Remember the world food crisis of the early 1970s. The Central Intelligence Agency came out with a study that said that food shortages weren't bad, they were good, Because the U.S. could use food power as a way of reclaiming our position of power throughout the world. At the same time, articles were coming out in various business magazines, one of which I remember, I think it was Business Week, was Can Agriculture Save the Dollar? The United States, for the first time, was starting to have major problems in our trade balance in the early 70s. And agriculture was seen, and the world food crisis came along, and we began to kind of balance things out by exporting. Earl Butz said, plant fence row to fence row, we'll export, export, export. So we became more and more desperate to export. Obviously, there are environmental costs to that. But there are also problems. For example, right now, the United States is attempting, this is my perspective at least, and I think there are a number of groups who share this, is attempting to basically take over the world's agricultural market. How do you do that? You try to undercut people's prices. You try to sell, you try to dump your grain on the market at as low a possible price so that you can regain control of markets. There are lots of problems with that. Because almost every expert that I know on world hunger will say that the solution, primary solution to the problem of world hunger must be through increased agricultural production within hungry or underdeveloped countries. If you dump a lot of grain on a market, go ahead. I'll be down here in just a minute if we want to. Where do you want to go? Go ahead.
On that particular subject, I just read recently, really, that one of the problems they have with exporting is that, you know, these other countries can produce more cheaply and they're undercutting our farmers. So how can you make a claim that we're trying to buy the market by undercutting them?
Okay, I'll get to that specific point in just a minute, and if I don't, bring it up again. For example, one of the things the United States did, sitting on a huge rice surplus, was it decided to cut the price of rice from about 14 cents down to 4 cents a pound. Okay? What we did then is we started selling rice at $3.50 for 100 weight of rice. In order to sell it, we then paid a $17 payment on every 100 weight of rice. So it was costing us $17 for every $3.50 worth of rice that we were exporting. Now that's one cost, but the other cost was one of the major rice exporting countries is Thailand. Thailand depends on rice exports to survive. That one action by the United States of reducing that price and selling rice now for $3.50 for 100 weight cost Thailand $69 million in export earnings. What happened in Thailand? As the U.S. 85 Farm Bill was being debated, there were riots outside of the U.S. Embassy in Thailand. There were riots, and now the social turmoil is increasing in Thailand. The hunger, suffering is increasing in Thailand, simply related to that dumping. Okay. Now, let me just say one other thing here about one of my fears. Now, this is a whole other subject area, so if you want to ask a question about it, you can, but it seems to me, well, the problem that we have in the United States right now, one of them, is that we have spent so much money in the military sector. We spent so much of our emphasis, our engineer time, our creativity in military production, that the United States is no longer effectively competing against Western Europe and Japan in most areas of economic production. What that means now is that the United States has moved in the last 6 years, this is the major legacy of the Reagan administration, where we're going to be living with and our children will be living with for generations, is we have moved from being the world's largest creditor country to being the world's largest debtor country. Our debt, you've heard about Mexico and Brazil, our debt is now equal to or greater to the combined debts of Mexico and Brazil. All that has happened within the last 6 years. What that means is we are paving the way for putting tremendous pressure on agricultural exports to try to raise the income to narrow that debt gap, to narrow the trade deficit, which I fear is going to have a tremendous long-term impact on the quality of our soils. Okay, let me just make two other things, and one of them addresses the point that you made. First one, there's another parallel here, or at least another relationship. We've been putting a lot of screws on, in a lot of ways, the underdeveloped countries to pay back their debts. One of the things that that means is that they don't have a lot of capital, they don't have a lot of money to invest in production, to invest in their own economy, or to buy U.S. goods, including U.S. farm goods. For example, the Latin American countries as a whole, in 1981, imported $119 billion worth of goods from the world. $119 billion worth of international trade was going into Latin America. In 1985, that figure was $50 billion. What that means is that there was a loss of $69 billion of purchases from Latin America from countries like the United States. That directly affects U.S. farmers because they don't have the money to buy U.S. farm products. It affects U.S. farmers in the second way, and that is, what are some of the big debtor countries? Brazil is one. Squeezing Brazil to pay back that debt, so what do? In response, the U.S. Tries to push these prices down, it goes a nickel lower because it's so desperate. What does Argentina produce? Argentina, among other things, produces wheat and cattle, two commodities that work directly in competition with U.S. farmers. U.S. pushes the prices down, it's going to try to take over the market. They are so desperate to pay that debt back that what do? They undercut us by a nickel or a dime. So it's a tremendously interrelated and destructive kind of policy. Okay. Let me just say one more thing and then open it up. It seems to me that what we need over the long term is we need to encourage the preservation of agricultural resources and land. The only way to do that is to have a fairer pricing system. The other thing I would say is that agriculture needs to be treated in a different way. It's not simply another commodity. Agriculture is part of the culture of societies. It's absolutely essential to people's security. And if we're really concerned, I think, about solving some of these problems, we're going to need to probably achieve in some way in the United States higher, fairer, more stable prices for U.S. agriculture, probably linked to environmental programs and probably linked to some kind of limits on the volume of production. In other words, we're going to have to interfere with the free market. We're going to have government intervention, but in a very different way than we've had. And the same is true on the world scene. If we're really concerned about breaking this cycle, there's going to have to be something done about debt, and there's going to have to be something done about changing the international pricing system that right now is literally strangling most of the underdeveloped countries, particularly in terms of agriculture. Okay, that's a lot of food for thought, so let's hash it around for a while. Yeah.
Is anything happening on the congressional level right now, either in committee or on the floor, to affect any of this, like to affect the international pricing system, for example?
Okay, in terms of the international pricing system, there is very little that's going on in terms of that has to be done more or less on a multilateral level. There are trade talks going on, and President Reagan was recently overseas in Europe somewhere talking about this, and he introduced a proposal that would eliminate all subsidies to agriculture by the year, 1995 or 2000 or something like that. So there are those kinds of talks going on because all the countries, Western Europe, the United States, are paying huge subsidies protecting their agriculture. I personally think that that's the wrong way to go for the reasons I think that I've laid out, that if you undermine indigenous agriculture, you create an incredible vulnerability. Now, there are other talks that were going on that go on within the United Nations framework that underdeveloped countries for 25 or 30 years have been clamoring for a new international economic order. Unfortunately, they have very little power. The power rests with the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and they've been real uneasy about interfering with. But I will tell you that what's going to, what may very well change that is this. Because it's my belief, and again, I may very well be wrong, but it's my belief that we're this close to the collapse of the international economy. In other words, the weight of the injustice of this system used to be borne by the poor, and still is. But we're this close to the system collapsing because of the weight of the injustice that it just can't hold up anymore. Let me give you one example. I gave it yesterday too, I think, that if Brazil doesn't pay its debt, just Brazil, or if just Mexico doesn't pay its debt, every major U.S. bank is bankrupt. That's the kind of issue that we're starting to face now. Now, quote unquote, fortunately for the United States, if you want to think this way, which I don't particularly do, but I'll say it this way, the elites in Brazil and the elites in Mexico have much more in common with trying to please the United States than they do worry about their own people. As long as they can impose this debt on the poor, they'll keep doing that because it's in their interest to keep this thing afloat. But I don't think it's going to go on much longer. So that's a forum where a lot of these issues are starting to come up, is the forums talking about the international debt and what to do about it. There's probably a lot of uneasy bankers in our country right now, not only in rural America because of the farm crisis, but the overall economic crisis.
The banks have begun to recognize that by writing off some of those loans. Some of those major
one of the major banks, was it Citicorp?
Several have
I think, put $3 billion into a fund anticipating losses. Now, $3 billion sounds like a lot of money. I believe that that's probably about, don't quote me on this, but I would guess it's between 2 and maybe 3%, something like that, of their debt to underdeveloped countries. So what I'm saying is, it sounds really, really good, but it's not. Well, you're shaking your head.
They've already written off somewhere around 60 or 70% of their debt to large banks.
To the underdeveloped countries?
Yeah.
I've never heard that before. Can you?
I don't have the figures with me, but Chase Manhattan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, all of them have large debts that took the hit in the last 4 quarters. Which had some devastating effect on the some of the banking statements.
Well, I know that they have started taking losses, and that's affected their earnings. But I think it's a much, much smaller percentage of their overall underdeveloped debt. But people can find that out. I may be wrong on that.
Aren't you talking about the difference between the interest payments per year and the overall debt? I mean, they may write off an interest payment.
Well, see, what they've been doing in terms of their debt is they've been offering more loans so that written into their books it says so that people can pay their interest. As long as they're paying your interest, you look okay. What they've done now in the last year or so, or a couple of years, is they've started to say, maybe we're not going to get this back, and maybe these loans, maybe we better start taking some of our losses. So they started doing that, but I think it's still a small fraction of what they owe. I still think the banking system is incredibly vulnerable right now in terms of this international banking crisis and the debt. How many of you are from rural areas? What's happening with your farmers? Things going well? Anybody want to?
Small farms are being gobbled up pretty much.
There's a lot of people.
In Wisconsin, the small 80-acre farm no longer exists. Buildings are there, people live in them, but they're farmed on a mass scale.
Is that mainly dairy?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
In Greeley, Colorado, I don't think there's anybody left in our congregation that just farms. Now they have to go into real estate. I'm thinking one family where the three sons all went into, one became a fireman, one became a policeman. only two sons, but they're moving into the city, and they're keeping enough of the farm just to have some land, and they're leasing out the rest of it because they just can't afford to, they can't afford the to go into the debt to get, it's just not paying off.
There's a real shakedown that's been going on in U.S. agriculture now for the last couple of years. Yes?
Well, the way I kind of look at it, and I would tend to agree with you, I think it's possibly a bad thing that we lose small farmers and farms become just bigger and bigger. But I think that's a problem in our society generally. I think most businesses are leaving the small enterprise or going to larger and larger operations. But I think in the agricultural arena, worldwide, I don't necessarily look on it as not getting a fair price. I look on it as farming worldwide has become so efficient that it's created an oversupply versus the demand. And that's really the crux of the problem. There's more food available than there are people to consume it. And I feel that a lot of countries that are facing starvation, it's a problem of getting the food to the people.
Yeah, let me just respond. I think essentially I agree with that. When I talked about that Forbes magazine article, and it said feeding the world's hungry millions, how it will mean billions for U.S. corporations, one of the things they assumed is that hungry people could afford to buy food, and hungry people can't afford to buy food. Hunger is a problem of essentially injustice that leaves people without any kind of purchasing power, any kind of productivity through which they can earn a living and then become consumers. So you have a situation where there is a lot of quote-unquote surplus food out there. Why? Because there simply isn't market demand. And the reason there isn't market demand is because our international economy and capitalism functions based on the market. It functions based on market demand. That means the poor are outside of that system. And that's one of the things that is threatening to bring down the whole system. Again, let me give you a very specific example. In a place like El Salvador or Guatemala, the elites who control those societies, they don't have to care about the poor people in their society because they are producers for an international economy. And they are consumers from the international economy. If the poor in your country can't afford to buy the crops that you're producing, that doesn't matter because you can find a rich consumer in the United States who will. And you can buy a product. You're part of that international global supermarket. The problem is where the poor become a problem is when they start organizing and making demands. And that's why there's so much militarization to put them down. But you're right, there's a lot of food out there, there's reasonably efficient production, there's a lot more potential for increased food production, but that doesn't get at the heart of the problem. The heart of the problem is that social inequality that I started with.
Well, we must have made a mistake in one area. I believe that would be India, because I have read, and I haven't been there, but I have read that because of a lot of the assistance that the U.S. gave to India and helping them develop their agricultural system, they actually now do have enough food to feed themselves, and they don't have to buy from the USA.
Yeah, India is one of the countries that participated in what was called the Green Revolution, modernizing its seeds, its technology, its fertilizers, etc., has greatly increased its food production. India is also a place, if you visit, what you will see is hundreds of thousands and millions of people who are living at a starvation level. Again, it's the same kind of problem, that the problem is not only producing more food. There's lots of opportunities for producing more food. The problem is structuring societies in a way that give people access to enough power to make consumer demands and also to be involved in the productive process. That's where India has failed miserably. So that in a generalized way, you can make that argument. There's a lot more production in a lot of areas of the world. But the key is not only production. The key has to do with the distribution systems that are possible. Yeah, here and then over here.
Well, who is it that's setting the price on the product, in your opinion, such that, say, our farmers claim that they can't get a reasonable price for almost any product you can name? You know, they say the costs of production are higher than what they can sell it for in the market. Now, who is it that's setting these prices that doesn't permit them to get it? I mean, is it the government, or is it just, you know, some conglomerates or business groups, or like your thoughts on it?
I think that the two of the major forces are government policies that set prices. It would be possible right now, more or less, what we do is we keep the prices fairly low, and then we keep whatever farm, you know, a lot of the farmers are kind of hanging in there based on subsidies that they receive. That's one way of doing it. That's different than a fair price system. And one of the proposals that has been thrown around and hasn't gotten real far, it was sponsored by Senator Harkin from Iowa, would basically call for a different approach. And that different approach would be for the government, along with others, this information is pretty clearly available, to figure out more or less how much of a given commodity, let's say wheat or corn, that we are going to, that there's going to be a market demand for within the United States. How much wheat or corn can we reasonably expect to export in the coming year? How much do we want for some kind of storage so we have some security in case of a bad year or whatever? Based on that, then allocations of acreage and production would be made, and the market then would basically determine the price. That's another option, but that's one that we've turned away from. But I think the people who set the price are basically the U.S. government and also oftentimes involved with U.S. companies. They have much more to say, the grain companies and others have much more to say about the price of food than farmers do. Farmers are have very little to do. And this is one of the things you see both happening with farmers and with underdeveloped countries, is the more you go into debt, doesn't matter if the price is lower, you'll try to produce more because you simply got to try to pay that debt, which just accelerates the problem of overproduction in relation to that demand. Would you agree with that or disagree with that? Or?
I guess so. You know, I think we're indirectly paying this fair price, but it's called a subsidy. You know, they set the price at 50 cents, and then the government pays billions of dollars back, you know, via another procedure to the farmer, so that they're getting that dollar. But then it has the impact on the rest of the markets. In the
world. Right. It very much distorts the rest of that market, which we say we're trying to keep free, which we're not doing.
Which then also seems to come, well, I don't know if it costs the country more one way or another. If all the consumers had to pay just a somewhat higher price to get the price up to where the farmers could afford to sell at profit, yeah, then maybe the consumers would scream.
Right.
It's probably politically a problem for who's ever in power.
What the Harkin bill says, in terms of the research that was done and verified by a number of different university studies, is that like this year now, subsidies to agriculture will be over $25 billion. I don't have the exact figures in my head, but they estimated that the cost would be greatly reduced under the system I just laid out. What would happen, however, is there would be a slight increase at the marketplace. So what they recommended doing is taking some of that subsidy savings, which was huge, I think it would have cost about a third of the $25 billion, take some of that and put it into food stamps, for example, so that the poorer sectors would still have a margin of, or they would be able to sustain themselves. So those are things that there's disagreement, I guess, on between different groups. But according to the Harkin bill and the background that they did, it would in fact save over the long run if you did it through the market rather than doing it through a subsidy, what we've been doing. Yeah, I've said here first, now I'll go back there.
Okay, I have a very basic question because I am quite sure I'm not the only person in this room who feels a tremendous sense of frustration and impotence in terms of impacting or having an effect on not only our own national policies, but then into the international complex. So as Christians and as concerned citizens, from your perspective, what's the best way for us to interact and to make a difference?
Okay, just I don't have one address with me, and I do have one, and I don't have an eraser. Maybe would someone be willing to run in and get an eraser? It's just a cloth. That's a other board. One group that works on a lot of this stuff, and I don't always agree with everything that it recommends, but it's certainly a good one, is Bread for the World. And Bread for the World is not, it doesn't give food relief. What it does is provides Christians primarily with updated information on legislative issues, thank you, that have to do with hunger. So, I don't, how many of you are members of Bread for the World? Fair number of you. And your congregations can also develop a special relationship with Bread for the World. So I think one answer to the question is simply to be more involved in the legislative process around these kinds of issues. That's one point of leverage. And then I'll put another one on, particularly for people who are interested in various kinds of approaches to solving the U.S. agricultural crisis. I think one of the most creative organizations that I'm aware of is a group called the North American Farm Alliance. And they're based out of Ames, Iowa. And I'll put their address up here. They worked very closely with Senator Harkin from Iowa in trying to come up with an alternative farm bill that would move away from the massive subsidies towards a more stable, fair price in agriculture. And they were quite sensitive to the issues of not trying to solve the U.S. agricultural crisis in a way that exports the problems on underdeveloped countries, which is a real danger in the present policy, I think. Yeah, you had a question.
Assuming that indeed that is correct, that the developed world owns the means of finance and we own the means of distribution and we determine the cash crops and the import-exports of the third world countries, if we allow that, and the implications and the problems that means for a farmer in a third world country, if I'm a, and given the inertia of those things, the inexorably slow change that is, if I'm a third world farmer and I say to you, Jack, give me a word of hope, what do you say?
Nicaragua. And this relates back to your question too, that I said in my presentation last night that there's very little hope for the hungry without two things happening. One is significant internal changes within societies that reorder priorities, resources, give people access to land through land reform, give people access to credit through some kind of banking reform or control of banks or nationalization of banks. Without that, there's very, very little hope. So I think it's important to see, and this is an unfortunate connection, but there definitely is a connection between why the United States government is so interested in destabilizing and overthrowing the Nicaraguan government. It's the only government in the region that is carrying out a land reform that is in fact turning land over to campesinos, that is in fact reorienting credit to get them productive. So a lot of these answers are indirect answers, but if we really are concerned about these issues, then we've got to start monitoring where do our military dollars go? What kind of policies do they support? The Contra vote coming up is an issue related to farming in Central America, and we need to see it in that way. So, if you had visited Nicaragua in 1980, 1981, beginning of 1982, you just felt this incredible hope because people were getting access to productive resources, which feeds on people's dignity. It helps that dignity grow. Now most of that's being destroyed by this Contra war. In El Salvador, I'll give you the opposite example. In El Salvador, the U.S. has helped push through what I call a very cosmetic land reform program. By the way, in Nicaragua's land reform, campesinos that get their land, they don't pay a cent for it. They're given title to their land and access to credit to get their crops in and start producing. In El Salvador, what the U.S. land reform program there was, it was basically a cosmetic reform, and what they did is they allowed the large landowners to sell off their worst land at inflated prices, and the campesinos who got that land inherited those inflated prices, and almost all of them are now going under. So that's, you know, again, I wish I had answers that said, oh, all we got to do is X. But there are so many other tie-ins. I mean, the foreign policy issues for the United States are directly tied in to these concerns. The issues of Central America, for example, and the Contra aid vote coming up, whether we support the kind of or give the kind of support we're giving to the government of El Salvador. That is a hunger-producing policy, from my point of view. And we need to see those relationships. Anybody over here? Yes.
I was thinking about, a couple of times you made remarks about ruining the land. I think we've exported our agricultural pollutants to the other countries too. And their demand for all this fertilizer and everything, that there's some long-range costs that we haven't even begun to touch.
One of the things that you see in Nicaragua, again, that's an example just because I know that country well, is during the time of the U.S.-backed dictatorship, the Somoza dictatorship, if you were a pesticide company, I believe, what is it, Sarah, you had to just pay $100? And then you could test any pesticide, something like that?
Yeah. Or maybe it might have been $1,000.
Or maybe it was $1,000. And you could use any test any pesticide, use any pesticide. Women in Nicaragua carry around what level? Again, Sarah's an expert on environmental health, so what is it? What percentage of the DDT?
Well, it's 42 times the allowable amount, according to the World Health Organization.
Of DDT, all related to that. Most of it related to the cotton expansion in the early 1950s and 1960s. And again, those aren't, you can't just blame that on U.S. pesticide companies. They're obviously cooperating with certain groups of people. But the result is that what the new Nicaraguan government inherited in 1979 was an environmental legacy which threatens the viability of that country in the future. There were no windbreaks planted, yeah. the destruction of the lakes and water resources.
We're doing the very same thing right here in this country. And I don't understand why we don't get alarmed about it. You know, I mean, the water tables are going down all over, and the land just washes away, and we just dump more junk on it. I remember living in an area that is now so filled with salts that no one farms it anymore.
In California?
No, it's here in Washington.
Here in Washington.
Yeah.
Saltification of soils.
A lot of places like that.
If people are interested in that issue from a kind of a biblical perspective, I did a 5 or 6 part series for congregational study for the American Lutheran Church a couple years ago called Water More Precious Than Oil. And it talks a lot about those examples of what's happening with U.S. agriculture in terms of runoff, in terms of contamination of underground water supplies, in terms of depleting underground water tables, saltification of soils, all of those things. And what frightens me is, again, the marketplace really doesn't account for the environmental sanctity for the future. I was at a conference at Wartburg Seminary in which an executive from a major implement dealer was speaking, an economist for them, was saying that it's no different to wear out the soil than it is to wear down a house. You know, because you'll eventually you just put enough capital in and somehow you'll rescue it. Well, the farmers were alarmed, the theologians were alarmed, and in response to any criticism, he just looked at him and said, look, economics is a scientific discipline. You don't have any business talking about this. But the problem is it doesn't, the environmental costs are not really factored very much into the market system.
They aren't with nuclear power, they aren't with our agricultural system, they're not with our throwaway society. You know, the bottle bill, we couldn't even pass that in this state, we tried twice.
And let me say that on the positive side, it seems to me that one of the things that this lays out is the need, again, for us in the churches, for us in the churches, right? We got so many things that we're responsible for trying to deal with. But I think it's to come up with a creation ethic, an environmental ethic that really speaks out as stewards. And I see some of that happening within the churches, and that's very encouraging. I see more creative debate going on about the how to solve the farm crisis over the last year and a half or 2 years that I've seen for a long time in this country. It's not all gloom and doom, but there simply is not the moral vitality or the environmental concern embedded in our ethic or the political will to really carry through on these. That doesn't mean that there can't be, it just means that our task is really fairly great. Yeah?
Let me make this a little... ask a question on a little more global basis.
Sure.
We're saying we have serious problems relative to handling support for third world countries. And accept that. That's a problem. And you're saying United States could do some things differently, specifically by certain bills and, you know, the way Congress deals with things. Valid. But if you look at European countries, Scandinavian countries, and from a financial world standpoint, more importantly, Japan, there are serious problems the United States is grappling with. Like we import more from Japan than we export.
Right.
So the United States is trying to solve global problems. If we make this problem a more global problem, and for starters, into our discussion incorporate, say, Japan, how would we proceed with world powers like Japan to go solve this problem?
Well, in fact, one of the things that desperately needs to happen is for those kind of discussions, and those, some of those are beginning to take place with Japan, with Western Europe, and the United States. They're very far apart on the issue of agriculture because agriculture in those societies, in Japan and in Western Europe, is a part of the fabric of the culture. And here it's become increasingly a business. And that creates a lot of problems. The other problem is that we've got to move beyond just Western Europe and Japan, kind of a trilateralist approach. Because in general, that trilateralist approach is not taking into consideration the needs of the majority of humankind, which happens to live in the developing or underdeveloped countries. So there's a desperate need to bring, yes, them into a discussion, but all the countries as well. We have to break for Vespers, but thank you.